You got the slide advancement? Okay, you're ready to go. You're ready to go, okay, good. Is it not working? You gotta turn it on.
It's on.
Is it?
Is that?
Yeah, it's on.
Okay, good.
Hold up.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We all ready for entertainment? I'm David Alkeck. I'm the president of this organization, the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We've been going on for about 35 plus years, bringing education to Dallas, the Metroplex. We're not the only ones, of course, but we do more than just philosophy, history, literature. Even we had a poet laureate of Oklahoma speak to us. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday from September through December, and then we start over again in January and end in May and take off the summer. We charge for our lectures, because we do have our expenses, it's $5, $2 if you're a full-time student, so you can see our treasurer if you haven't already done so. Make sure that you do take care of your server tonight. Don't forget to tip them, because, you know, they do have to make a living too. Can you hear me all right? But
a little more.
All right. All right. And so, let's see what else we need to talk about. Anything else? We will have Dr. John Mears next time. He's a professor emeritus of history at SMU. He will speak on living on the hinge of history. We have Rob Olson in November, an adjunct professor at SMU, who will speak on artificial intelligence. And then on November the 28th, Dr. Jim Mueller from University of North Texas will talk on the ethics of journalism. And then in December, Dr. Cal Gilson from SMU, we like SMU, by the way, will talk on history in politics and fiction. Okay, so tonight we have with us Dr. Kirsten Eggerstrom, who hails from St. Paul, Minnesota, went to high school there. Her high school, she said, was located next to the world's largest snowman. And I know Minnesota is up north, but it doesn't melt, does it?
Minnesota doesn't melt now.
It's a stucco snowman. It's 44 feet tall. She went to college at Cornell in Mount Vernon, Iowa. And after a year of hating a job in human resources, decided to go for her MA degree in philosophy. And I guess you found out that you can't do much with an MA in philosophy, so she worked as a restaurant server for a year before she hated that, and moved to Syracuse for her serious PhD in philosophy. And immediately after getting her, doing her dissertation, she was hired the next day to come to SMU to teach in the philosophy department here. So that just shows you you really need your PhD in philosophy to get somewhere, huh? She teaches courses on normative and applied ethics, and her primary research area is meaningfulness in life. Well, we all need to know that. She's going to talk about two models of meaningless lives against the failed agent model of meaningfulness. And so without any further ado, please welcome Dr. Kirsten Eggerstrom.
Thank you, so much for having me. This is really fun. Is this thing working?
Yeah, it's working.
All right, so we give a talk on meaningfulness in life. Really, it's mostly on meaninglessness in life. That's all gets you here in Sunday. But I want to make it clear what I'm not talking about, which is the question of what the meaning of life is, which I'm not sure has an answer. There's a joke there with anyone who's seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or the book, The Answer to 42. The question itself might be nonsensical, right? Instead, I'm interested in the question of what makes individual lives meaningful. And typically when we talk about our lives being meaningful or meaningless, what we're talking about is whether or not our lives are significant or worthwhile or they have a point of purpose. Sometimes when we talk about meaningfulness, we're evaluating other people's lives as meaningful. So we might say, for example, that Mother Teresa's life was meaningful, or Martin Luther King Jr. His life was meaningful. Just to be clear, philosophers kind of distinguish between meaningfulness as a value of a life, happiness, and morality. And one reason why you might want to differentiate between meaningfulness and happiness is that it seems as though we make trade-offs between these two values in our lives. For example, many psychological studies have supported the parenthood paradox. It appears that raising children appears to significantly impair a person's happiness while simultaneously adding meaning to her life.
Okay.
There also appear to be examples of lives that, if you thought about it, seem intuitively meaningful. But... Oh, okay, sure, yeah, sure. No problem. Sorry, guys. There seem to be, let me just grab these two guys up here in case I know. Okay, so there appear to be lives that seem intuitively meaningful, but did not seem to be very happy. So Mother Teresa was not apparently a very happy person. This is Paris Hilton. I probably shouldn't be this judgmental. But we could say maybe that her life is maybe very happy, but not very meaningful. It seems to lack the sort of depth and significance that we might attribute to a meaningful life. Also, I mentioned that meaningfulness appears to be perhaps a distinct concept from morality. Now, there are some philosophers who have argued that immoral activities cannot contribute to the meaningfulness of a person's life, right? And maybe that's true, but conceptually, these are two different concepts and two different values of a life. And contemporary philosophers have been arguing that there are activities like running or gardening that may not be super morally praiseworthy, but nonetheless meaningful. Right? So we'll assume that meaningfulness is distinct from these two other concepts. What I want to do now is go over some important distinctions and concepts that philosophers working on this material discuss. Here's a big one. Some philosophers who work on meaningfulness in life are subjectivists. They think that if a person finds her life to be meaningful, it is thereby meaningful. And what this means is that if there's some type of positive attitude toward her life or a part of her life that is present, this is sufficient for her life to count as meaningful. This may include something like a desire, a feeling of satisfaction or fulfillment, love or active engagement, and the idea being that if you're a subjectivist, let's say you are Harry Frankfurt, right? You might argue that as long as you love someone else, right, your life is meaningful as a result of loving that other person, right? Now, you might argue, though, that there might be some relationships that don't add meaning to your life, right? The relationship doesn't seem objectively valuable, right? Or maybe you love torturing puppies, in which case someone might argue that that can't possibly add meaning to your life. And as a result, most philosophers today are actually objectivists. They do not think that it's sufficient for one's life to actually be meaningful, that she finds her life to be meaningful. An objective condition has to be met as well, and usually that objective condition is objective value. So one will say that, yeah, maybe we want to talk about activities that people are passionate about, or they find fulfilling, or that they love. But it also has to be the case that those things are objectively valuable in order for one's life to be made meaningful as a result. And usually philosophers want to rule out people who find meaning in activities that are morally reprehensible, or there seem to be activities that seem trivial or pointless or worthless, right? Counting paperclips. You might be really passionate about counting paperclips, but the activity doesn't seem to be very worthwhile, right? And there's tons of examples in philosophical literature of worthless activities, you know, maybe playing Candy Crush Saga all day long on your phone would not be something that would make your life meaningful. When it comes to objectivism, I'm going to be focusing on hybrid conceptions. Right? So if you are a hybrid conception philosopher, you think that both a subjective condition and an objective condition are both required for a life or an activity to count as meaningful. Right? In other words, it's not enough that one finds one's life to be meaningful, but one needs to. It also has to be the case that that which one finds meaningful is objectively valuable. Right? So let's say both of those things are required. And this is intuitive because, again, if it were the case that merely being passionate about something made your life more meaningful, right, presumably people can find meaning in literally anything. And philosophers don't want that to be the case on the whole. Right? So most philosophers are actually objectivists, and they are going to say both of those conditions have to be met. And we'll just, this really, not a lot rides on this, but we'll just assume that that is true. Another thing to point out, and this is really important for this presentation, which is that most philosophers accept that agency is also a requirement for meaningfulness. Right? In fact, most philosophers, when they talk about meaningful lives, are actually talking about what makes an activity meaningful. And the assumption is that if one is engaged in meaningful activities, her life is therefore made meaningful as a result of that. Right? But the idea is that you have to be doing something in order for that thing to make your life meaningful. Right? And part of the motivation for this emphasis on agency is that there do seem to be examples of lives that seem to be paradigmatically meaningless because agency is absent. And it's also the case that, I mean, imagine that a friend of mine finished her dissertation. She defended her dissertation. Even if I was really excited for my friend, it's hard to see how my friend's dissertation defense could make my life more meaningful unless I had done something to help my friend complete that dissertation. Right? And I have a pretty funny example here. This is my husband, actually, who is the blob. And this is an example of Susan Wolf's. Susan Wolf provides an example of a paradigmatically meaningless life. This is someone who spends day after day or night after night in front of the television set, drinking beer and watching situation comedies. Now, this is a not a normal situation for my husband to be in. This was staged for a different presentation. Just want to point that out. But what philosophers will do is they'll posit an example of this sort of life, and we'll go, yeah, that seems meaningless. And then we'll ask, what is it about the life that seems meaningless? Well, it seems as though the blob's life is really passive. The blob doesn't really do anything, right? Now, the blob has to pick up beer cans, right? So there's some activity involved there, but it's pretty minimal, right? Okay. This emphasis on activity as being a requirement for meaningfulness does raise some interesting questions, right? Which I don't know why I've thought a lot about this fan question, but is it enough that one is a fan of a sports team? Does that count as activity in some sense, being a fan, such that cheering for your team can make your life meaningful? Because it sure seems as though for some people, sports, being a fan of a sports team makes your lives meaningful. But not a lot of activity is involved there. Right? Or you might have a parent who is really proud of their child who succeeded even despite them, right? So their, you know, crappy parent weren't there for their child. Their child succeeds a lot, right? Can that child's success make their parent's life meaningful, even if the parent did nothing to bring about that child's success? I think this is not the focus of my presentation, but I think these are interesting questions that I'd love to chat about in the Q&A if anyone is interested in those. What we can say of agents is that they are capable of intentional action. We are all agents. We act for reasons. And we might add on to this. It's not only a requirement that one be engaged in activity for that to be added, you know, add meaning to their lives. We can add on there that, you know, if I have an achievement, that achievement has to be deliberate and non-accidental. Right? So this is one of Barrett Brogauer and Barry Smith's example. You can imagine a Forrest Gump type person who affects the world in positive ways over and over again, but always by accident. Right? It could be that you have someone who affects the world in positive ways and doesn't even know it. Right? The idea being that you have to be intentionally bringing about some sort of end. It needs to be deliberate and not accidental in order for that thing to add meaning to your life. This is an assumption that a lot of philosophers have. Okay. Now, before I get into a description of this view, that in a sense I'm objecting to in this presentation, I want to give just a little bit of a motivation for what it is that I'm working on. My dissertation was mostly on meaninglessness in life. I thought that most philosophical literature on meaning in life focused on the positive aspect and not so much the negative. And I think that that's a problem because, for one, people who experience meaninglessness in their lives tend to be people who are suffering, right, in various ways. So we have a real pragmatic reason here to address this topic. And what inspired me to start the dissertation on this topic was some previous experiences of mine. You know, when I was a kid, for example, my next door neighbor losing her spouse. I had my own loss of faith when I was like 16. These sorts of radical experiences, to me, were the sort of catalysts for meaningless periods in people's lives. Right? And when I looked at psychological literature on this subject, it sort of confirmed, right, these sort of experiences that I had had. And in particular, one psychologist, Roy Baumeister, who's written extensively on the subject, argues that when one is in a meaningless period in her life, she feels empty, she may experience a lack of feelings or emotions, she may feel that she's lost an important part of her identity, she may feel stuck in the present, that she's lost her future, and it may be an aimless period in which one lacks any purposes or motivations. This sounds pretty terrible. Okay. And the idea that meaninglessness is pretty terrible is consistent with an idea that a lot of philosophers bring up, which is that it's when you have meaning in your life, you have a reason to keep living. People who are suicidal may be people who view their lives as meaningless. So, and this idea is a pretty radical state to be in. But when you look at philosophical literature on meaninglessness, what you end up seeing are a bunch of examples of paradigmatically meaningless lives, many of which are very funny, like the blob, right? None of which seem to get to the heart of these sort of existential crises that people have. And so I think that this emphasis on these examples of meaningless lives is overly simplistic, and really that there's some underlying condition that is taking place that explains why some lives do appear to be meaningless. So this will make more sense as I go through here. But here we have the view that most philosophers on meaningfulness accept, which is that meaningfulness is a concept, it's an achievement concept. When we evaluate people's lives as meaningful, usually we mean that their lives are admirable, excellent, significant, or commendable. Again, on this approach, philosophers will often point to greatly meaningful lives, ones that seem greatly meaningful, and then try to figure out what features those lives have, right? And then develop an account of meaningfulness based on that. And just to give you an idea, right, of the sort of philosophical view that supports this model, you've got Antti Kapanen, who has developed an apt emotions view. He says that meaningful lives, the concept, are ones that are fitting of pride, fulfillment, or admiration. So he states that in order to figure out what makes the life meaningful, we just need to figure out when those attitudes or emotions are fitting. And he goes on to tell us when these attitudes or emotions are fitting. He says your heart needs to be in what you're doing, otherwise it really wouldn't be your action to take pride in. He says it requires the setting of objectively valuable goals. It requires you overcoming a difficult challenge because it would not be appropriate to feel pride in accomplishing goals that are super easy to achieve. And this includes not just putting in effort, but applying skill. Because according to Kopfman, cleaning toilets every day, it seems meaningless because it requires a lot of effort, but very little skill, according to him. Also, he thinks that success is a requirement. Many philosophers accept that at the very least, failure detracts from the overall meaningfulness of a project that one is engaged in. Okay, now this is where my thesis comes into play, because I'm more interested in meaninglessness in life. And it seems as that if we analyze meaningfulness as being an achievement of agency, then one might argue that we ought to analyze meaninglessness in life as a type of agental failure. And this analysis of meaninglessness is consistent with many of the examples of paradigmatically meaningless lives mentioned in the literature. And it's also consistent with an analysis of meaninglessness that another philosopher who supports this apt emotions or fitting emotions view provides. According to Thad Metz, if meaningful lives are ones that are fitting of pride or admiration, meaningless lives are ones that are fitting of shame, contempt, or abhorrence. And this, I realize there's a lot of text on here, my apologies, but this is like getting to the heart of it. What I want to suggest is that this failed agent model is exaggerating the extent to which we have control over the meaningfulness of our lives. And it seems to encourage the belief that we are chiefly blameworthy if our lives fail to be meaningful. In contrast, I want to suggest a victimized agent model of meaninglessness. If meaningfulness in life requires agency, as most philosophers accept, then any condition that undermines one's ability to act as an agent would also undermine her ability to lead a meaningful life. And when you look at psychological literature on this and some philosophers who are writing on this topic right now, it seems that it's victims of trauma, demoralization, and profound loss that are ones whose agency is typically undermined in these cases. Right? So imagine if those who are leading this sort of extreme example of a meaningless life are those who are victims, in some sense. This seems pretty inconsistent with labeling meaningless lives as ones that are fitting of shame, contempt, and abhorrence. Some serious victim blaming going on right there. Okay. Now, what I'm going to do in just a second here is to give you an example of some paradigmatic meaningless lives that are mentioned in the literature. And what these philosophers are doing in these cases is they're starting with pointing to examples of lives that seem just sort of intuitively meaningful or meaningless. And they're going to try to come up with necessary and sufficient conditions that explain what makes that life meaningful or meaningless. And when it comes to meaninglessness, most philosophers seem to be more interested in meaningfulness, right? So usually when they're theorizing about meaninglessness, they're just trying to figure out what those lives lack in order to figure out what a positively meaningful life has. And the assumption then being that whatever a meaningful life is, a meaningless life is just the absence of that condition. Okay. Based on this sort of standard approach, then, there could be various ways in which an agent can sort of mess up to render her life absent of meaninglessness. Right? So you have people like the Blob who are just inactive. They're not active at all. So that life might count as meaningless. You have failed evaluators. You have people who evaluate their activities or goals as valuable when, in reality, they're not. You've got failed means and reasoners. You have people who fail to take the appropriate means to accomplish their goals. You've got failures of achievement, and by this I mean people who fail at accomplishing their goals. And then failures of introspection. According to one philosopher, one thing you should do in order to make your life meaningful is to figure out your passion in life and pursue it. The implication being then that some people fail to live a meaningless life or meaningful life because they failed to take the time to reflect on who they really are, right? What their real desires are, what their real passions are in life. And if they just spent that time doing that self-discovery, they'd figure it out and then they just go pursue that. In each of these cases, you know, there are some external conditions that can, you know, undermine people's ability to engage in these sort of practices. But a lot of these are practices that we sort of require people to take up on their own. Okay. So I'm going to go through this list of examples of meaningless lives that have been discussed in the literature. And one thing to point out, right, when you look at examples like the blob, it's not clear if the philosopher who comes up with an example like this is intending for that example to be like a part of a life or a whole life. And what I mean by that is, most of us are engaged in multiple different activities at the same stage in our lives. Is it the case that we're trying to imagine one engaged in just one of those parts of their lives? Right. Here's one example of an activity one could be engaged in. Right. Or is the goal to imagine someone who does this one activity for their entire lives? Right. Now, what I'm going to suggest here in a second is that when you focus on these examples of meaningless lives and assume that they're just parts of someone's life, none of them seem inherently that problematic. But when you imagine that one is engaged in one of these meaningless lives for their entire lives, then you start to ask yourself, what's wrong with this person? There has to be some underlying explanation for why one would be playing Candy Crush Saga all day long for the entirety of their lives. Right? That can't be the end of the story. So the view seems like overly simplistic. Okay, and just real quick, if we see that meaningfulness is a quality of life that some lives possess and others lack, and which we desire for its own sake, it would seem that meaninglessness is a quality that some lives possess and others lack, and one that is undesirable to possess. Importantly, meaninglessness would be something worth avoiding for its own sake. Yeah, again, when we conceive of these lives as partial lives, as I'll discuss here in a second, none of them seem, well, most of them don't seem inherently undesirable. Okay, so here's the first example, the hedonist life. One interpretation of the blob is not that the blob is passive, but that the blob pursues just pleasure. The blob really likes drinking beer and watching TV, and so that's the goal of the blob. Right. Now, I'm not sure that someone who pursues pleasure and just doesn't care about meaningfulness in life, if that's necessarily that big of a deal, right? Because we are going to assume that happiness and meaningfulness are distinct values of a life. Right? Certainly, we are all the blob sometimes. Right? I was the blob this entire weekend. I had a fall break. I've been the blob for 4 days. Right? And sometimes you need to be the blob. Right? So if it's just for a short amount of time, it doesn't seem like a problem really at all. Right? Now, you can contrast this sort of commitment to pleasure seeking, right, with a different example. And this is from Viktor Frankl, who is a psychologist, and he was a Holocaust survivor. And he writes about his experiences in a concentration camp. And he talks about how prisoners would exchange cigarettes for food. And interestingly, he said that the prisoners would know when someone had given up on their lives because they would be smoking. And interestingly, the way that he explained this is that since there were no sources of meaning left for these folks to pursue, since they saw no reason left to live, they switched over to seeking immediate pleasure. Right? They wanted the pleasure of the cigarette. That was sort of the last thing they had left, right, to enjoy. Now, in this particular case, you don't have someone who's like, you know, I really like drinking beer. I really like watching TV. I'm going to do this. Right? That could be the blob. In this case, you have people who are systematically ruled out from pursuing meaning in their lives, right, and sort of turn to pleasure, right, as a sort of secondary thing, because they've lost the capacity to pursue meaning. Okay. You've got the destructive life. This would fit into the category of someone who is a field evaluator, most likely. Okay. So you have some people whose life seems to have a point, but a very destructive one. Thad Metz brings up this example. Someone who just burns works of art. Right? Thad Metz thinks that such a person may actually have a negative meaningful life. Right? Their life might actually have a disvalue to it. Those I found to be horrifying. But anyway, One subcategory of the destructive life might be the degrading life, where what you destroy is your own sort of personal value. You've got the pointless life. Right? I'm sure some of you have heard of Sisyphus before, but Sisyphus was condemned to roll a boulder to the top of the hill, right, over and over again. Right? Sisyphus gets to the top of the hill with the boulder rolls down. Right? Nothing ever comes of what he is doing. And so one type of objectively valueless life seems to be the pointless life in the sense of nothing ever comes from it. I've heard people use this example to characterize the life of a corporate executive who makes more money, to invest more money, to make more money, and nothing really comes out of it, right? Sorry if they're corporate executives too. Interestingly, Richard Taylor, who had the Sisyphus example, has also argued that meaningful lives are creative lives. Imitative lives, on his view, might be meaningless. Interestingly enough, it could be that someone who chooses to have kids, right, because their parents chose to have kids, and tries to raise their kids exactly how their parents raised them, might, according to Richard Taylor, lead a meaningless life. Right? Sort of a strange view. You got the trivial life, right? Maybe we can imagine that Sisyphus, the goal is not to roll a boulder, but to put a flag on top of the hill before returning down. In this case, the activity has a point, right? But the end doesn't seem to justify the means. Maybe counting paper clips all day long would be an example of a trivial activity one might engage in. Okay, I'm going to skip over that right there for a second. Okay, the feudal life, we lived in Syracuse before, and every day we'd wake up during the winter, and there'd be more snow, and more snow, and more snow, endless. So in this case, the activity is a point, and the means are proportionate to the end, but the means are an ineffective way to acquire the end. It seems that one, perhaps, way of addressing the futile life would be to set really low expectations for yourself, to be really easy to come up with a means to accomplish your end. And that actually is an example of maybe another meaningless life, is the low expectation life, right? And this, I think, interestingly, relates to another example. So you have someone who sets low expectations for themselves. That on its own doesn't seem to be that problematic, right? In fact, if someone is feeling pretty bad about themselves, it might be a good idea to set low expectations for a while to build up your confidence, right? So you can set goals with higher expectations in the future. So it doesn't seem inherently problematic. And you can contrast the life of someone who just is setting low expectations for themselves at the moment with someone who has experienced demoralization. And someone who has experienced demoralization, as one philosopher describes, ceases to see a reason to engage in practical deliberation about what to do, and they cease to see reasons to pursue that which they value. According to Cheshire Calhoun, who writes on this topic, the point of deliberation is to affect the world through one's actions. Most people believe that they can be successful in affecting the world in the way they intend. However, people experiencing poverty, for example, may find that even the simplest plans, such as taking a bus to work or supplying one's children with required school pencils, are constantly or chronically vulnerable to derailment. Calhoun suggests that some people who feel that their lives are out of their control believe that their lives are controlled by luck or other people, and such people may question the purpose in deliberating about what to do if, after they have chosen their ends, they have no faith that through their agency they will be able to achieve those ends. This more sort of radical state of demoralization seems a heck of a lot more problematic than someone who's just setting low expectations for themselves. Okay. I won't go through all of these, but you got the Truman Show. I'm sure a lot of people like that movie. It could be that someone believes that their spouse is loyal to them, but in reality, they never come to find out that their spouse has been cheating on them for the last 20 years, something like that. The idea being that a life that is where you have true beliefs is more meaningful than a life where you have false beliefs about how well your life is going. The field life, Susan Wolf, points to a farmer who plans to hand the farm down to the children, but the farm goes into foreclosure right before that. She thinks that it wouldn't be inappropriate to refer to one's life as a total loss in such a case. see more of the youth who get the frustrated life. Clearly, if having your desires satisfied contributes to the meaningfulness of your life, having them constantly frustrated would be a problem. You've got the alienated housewife. This is someone who does not identify with her activities. The activities are not expressive of her true self. Then you have the bored life. Person who's not fulfilled or excited by our activities. And I want to pause on the bored life for a second here. Many philosophers have talked about boredom in the context of meaninglessness. Right? In fact, I encourage people to look up, there's a lot of literature on immortality. And a lot of philosophers argue that an immortal life would be undesirable because you would eventually get bored, and you would be bored for eternity. Right? And so boredom seems to be one of those conditions that people think, you know, undermines the meaningfulness of our lives. Now, here's another case where we can talk about boredom in the more ordinary sense, right? And boredom in a more radical sense. When one is bored in the more ordinary sense, right, part of what causes that boredom is that there are other things the person would rather be doing. Right? She's excited about, you know, going to a movie, or if there are students in my classes, doing anything other than being in my class. But what explains part of why they're bored is that they have other things that they're interested in. Now, you can compare someone who's experiencing ordinary boredom with someone experiencing a more radical type of boredom. And when it comes to this more radical type of boredom, which some philosophers have focused on, it seems as though this boredom can be all-encompassing. One can't even think about an activity that one wouldn't find to be boring. And one of the things I'm going to do here in a second is to say that in many of these cases of meaningless lives, especially when we focus on them as being parts of our lives, these are ordinary phenomena that we all experience in our lives. We are bored sometimes. We don't always identify with our activities. Right? Sometimes we do tasks because we have to, even though they seem futile. Right? Sometimes we engage in tasks that, you know, seem pointless. This is just what life is about. Right. And in fact, it could be argued that when it comes to boredom, someone who's living a highly meaningful life might be bored more often, because there's way more stuff that person would like to be doing other than the task at hand. But if you're a responsible adult, sometimes you're going to have to clean your house, and you're going to have to go grocery shopping, right? And so it can't be that every time you're bored, your life is rendered meaningless, right? That seems to be too extreme of a claim. Okay. When looking at these examples of meaningless lives, it seems that solving these problems would be relatively straightforward. You could sit down with someone who, you know, in each of these cases, who feared their life was meaningless, and you could say, look, you just need to find an activity that's actually worthwhile. Just pursue that. You need to set more realistic goals. Or maybe, you know, what you need to do is sit down and figure out your passions in life and pursue those. Solving meaninglessness then seems to be pretty easy in a sense. Okay. There also seems to be an assumption here. If you take, for example, Susan Wolf's view that a meaningful activity is one a person finds fulfilling and one that is objectively valuable, right? We regularly lose activities. Maybe we fail. Maybe we're fired. Right? There are sources of meaning in our lives that are lost. Do our lives plummet into meaninglessness every single time we're fired or we fail at an activity or a project? I don't think so. I think our lives retain pretty steady levels of meaningfulness, especially when we think about meaning as providing a reason for one to keep living. Right? I mean, for someone to feel that they don't have a reason to keep living, that's a pretty significant stance to take on one's life. Right? And it can't just be that, well, I just failed at this project and now my life is meaningless. Right. Okay. As a result, what's interesting is that we can explain these sort of more radical types of these behaviors in terms of pointing to background conditions that must be met in order for one to act as an agent. Right. And this is based on an article by Cheshire Calhoun. Example. Right. Imagine someone whose spouse just died. In such a case, it could be that all of their plans, their goals, their projects, all involves that person. Okay. Their spouse dies, they no longer have all of these sources of meaning that were related to or attached to their spouse. It could be that living the life of an agent, pursuing ends and goals, caring about doing various things, is somewhat premised on our ability to pursue those things that we deeply identify with, that we deeply care about. Another background condition of agency. We need to have faith in our ability to be successful as agents in order to act as agents. You need, for example, to believe that you can obtain the resources that you need to achieve your goals in order to take the initiative to try to achieve them. Sustained poverty could undermine this faith. People also need to feel that they have enough control over their lives to make it rational to pursue goals. If you think that your life is just merely a product of fate, right, or good or bad luck, or your life is in controlled by others, you're probably not going to be, taking up the project of setting goals for yourself and trying to achieve them if there's no reason to believe that the effort you put in can result in an accomplishment of your goal, right? Because other factors will come into play that undermine that. And finally, trauma. Well, there's a ton of literature and psychological literature on trauma. And what many psychologists say is that people are relying on a stable set of assumptions about how the world is organized and operates. For example, we all work with the assumption that the world is predictable, benevolent, and just, that we are good people, deserving of good things happening to us, and that we have some control over our lives. But traumatic events, whether it's sexual assault or an accident, have the ability to undermine these stable assumptions that we have about the world. For example, Roy Baumeister has argued that victimization through crime or accident disproves the world as benevolent, threatens one's view of the world as fair, and it undermines the positive view of oneself as someone who deserves positive, desirable things to happen. One who has one's basic assumptions about the world undermined is going to find it very difficult and challenging to operate as an agent in the world. Okay. I'm going to skip over this real quick, but what this is going to do is just say that these background conditions can more account for real-life crisis of meaning. So for those of you who haven't read Leo Tolstoy's A Confession before, it's his memoir, most of it detailing his experiences with meaninglessness in his life. I would encourage you to check that out. Okay. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but I've looked at quite a bit of phenomenological literature on the subject matter. And Matthew Rockcliffe, in particular, is one who focuses on ordinary versus radical boredom. Right? And so for Rockcliffe, if one experiences radical boredom, everything is encompassed by it, and no sense remains of there being any possibilities for anyone that fall outside of this boredom. You also have phenomenological literature on specifically on meaninglessness. Right? So Tim Oakley wrote a paper on meaninglessness, and he says, rather than finding ourselves deprived of the things we value, such as when we fail or lose someone in our lives, when experiencing meaninglessness, we find that we do not value anything, or at least not anything very much. Rather, we find ourselves rather than finding ourselves frustrated in our pursuits, we find our pursuits undermined by doubts about the worth of their objects. And finally, there is quite a bit of literature on hopelessness. And there's a difference between losing a specific hope, like I hope that I will publish this paper, and losing the capacity to form hopes in the first place. And the way that Steinbach wrote of despair, which is this sort of radical hopelessness, he says, when I despair, I experience the future as closed off of meaningful possibilities that should otherwise be there. Now, in conclusion, I realize I just went through this literature very quickly, but what seems to be the case of radical boredom, despair, and meaninglessness is that when you're experiencing these different types of phenomena, they limit not only your present possibilities, but close off possibilities for the future. Perhaps in the case of meaninglessness, if one is experiencing this, one cannot imagine one's future self successfully engaged in projects and pursuits that matter or which one finds valuable or worthwhile. And this is actually more intuitive than it sounds, because I suggested before that ordinary boredom, failure, and loss, right, these are normal elements of our lives. Most of the time, they don't render our lives ultimately meaningless. Right? If I get fired from my job, for me, that's just not going to be that big of a deal. It's going to be a bummer, but it's not going to be that big of a deal because there are other jobs that I would like to have, right? And I will seek out one of those other jobs. And the fact is, what's interesting is, you know, with relationships, especially when you're early on, it's a bummer when your relationship ends, but you think to yourself, okay, well, there are other people who I can be in a relationship with. It's not the end of the world. What is true, it seems like, of meaninglessness is that these future possibilities are closed off, right? One can't imagine an activity one would engage in that one would find valuable. I think this really gets the heart of what's happening when people are facing these crises of meaning. And as a result, our ability to avoid meaninglessness is actually contingent on our ability to project ourselves out of the present and into a future, an imagined future where we are successfully pursuing ideals we are committed to, projects that we care about, and roles that we value, and a relationship with people we care about. What is true of these three phenomena that I just went over, profound loss, demoralization, and trauma, is that they have the capacity to undermine our ability to project ourselves into the future. Right. And there are various, I can go into detail in Q&A what, you know, various reasons why these have the power to do that. Right. But to conclude here, one way of interpreting what I've been doing here is to say that I'm working on one type of meaninglessness, and other philosophers are working on this other type of meaninglessness. That's possible. Maybe I'm talking about, you know, profound meaninglessness, and they're talking about ordinary meaninglessness. One issue I see with this is that it's still unclear to me why people who live lives that are exemplify one of these examples of paradigmatically meaningless lives, why that's not big of a deal. Right. At the very least, I would argue that it's this type of meaninglessness that we ought to seek to avoid in our lives. Right? Unfortunately, this is somewhat out of our control, right? Because clearly being victimized is usually outside of your control. And what this does mean, then, that it may be that your ability to live a meaningful life, right, is contingent on your acting as an agent, but your ability to avoid meaninglessness in your life may be largely outside of your control. And those people who do experience this tend to be victims of external circumstances, so that we should now be thinking about meaninglessness as being this sort of failure on the part of agents. And that's it.
Questions then?
Questions? Yes.
Of course, I started out by saying you weren't going to talk about the meaning of life, but so much of what you did talk about seemed to, in terms of meaninglessness or meaningfulness, seemed to combine both subjective meaning and objective meaning. I can understand subjective meaning, although it's a little difficult for me to define for you what is subjective meaning. But when you get to objective meaning, it seems like you have to find meaning to life or assume that it exists in order to find objective meaning. I can have subjective meaning to myself. I can have subjective meaning to you, depending on what my interaction with you is, directly or indirectly. But I don't know how you can determine what objective meaningfulness or meaninglessness is. It seems like you're assuming that there's a God. So I'd like you to comment on that. What is objective meaningfulness or meaninglessness?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I would say that most people who focus on, who are objectivists, assume that activities that you're engaged in, right, doesn't matter how much you enjoy them, if they're objectively worthless, they don't have objective value, they can't advance your life. Now, this does require the existence of there being objective value. And certainly some people have argued that there can't be objective value if there's no God. Some philosophers working on this adopt like supernatural views of meaningfulness, but a lot of them adopt naturalist views on this. And the assumption is that we don't necessarily need a God for there to be objective value. Right? Now, I don't have necessarily a good response. Like, that's a really tough question. But what Susan Wolf says, for example, and she's someone that, you know, everyone reads on this topic, is that we have an intuitive sense that there are some things that are more valuable than other things. Helping cure cancer versus counting paper clips. We have an intuitive sense of what, you know, some things are being more valuable than others. And one final conclusion is, I do think that these questions are more related than people like to make them out to be. So it could be, for example, that someone who believes that the universe is meaningless, human lives are in general meaningless, that it will be difficult for some of those folks to say, yet I can still find individual meaning in my own life. Right? Some people think there is a closer connection between those two things, if that helps.
I'd like to ask a question. It seems like it's the perspective that you're looking at the person's at meaningfulness or meaninglessness. Are you looking at the perspective of the person? Is it meaningful or what for my life?
Yeah.
Or from society? Is society looking at that person? If that's what you're calling subjective and objective. Is society looking at it and saying, your life is meaningful or meaningless? And there's a third possibility, and that's a supernatural being, you know, the monk that sits in his cell and prays all the time and praises God and says, well, I get meaning from God. So where is that meaning? Where's the perspective?
Yeah, so what some philosophers have focused on is this idea that in order for something to be meaningful, it has to be meaningful to someone. Right? In which case, maybe some things are meaningful to me, some things are meaningful to our community. I might be meaningful to my husband. And the assumption being that maybe there has to be a God so that our lives are meaningful to a God. But I think that it's not necessarily the case that this value has to be one that has perspective to it. Yes, when it comes to subjective meaning, what we're saying is that I find this thing to be meaningful. But when it comes to objective meaning, most philosophers want to figure out what has to be in a life to make that life have meaning all on its own. It could be that all of us, the rest of us, think that your life is worthless, but it could still be meaningful, right? Because you have some sort of elements in your life that make it meaningful apart from what we think about it. Right? And I think most philosophers try to go in that route.
Yes. David said exactly what I was going to say, but I'll say something else. Yeah, I think that you have to decide whether the word meaningful means meaningful to yourself in terms of your own goals and own feelings of self-worth, or whether you're judging it as meaningful in the community. And of course, if you're Kim Jong-un, it might be meaningful to the Korean people in an objective sense, if you like, but not valuable anyway to the rest of the community. And I think a lot of scientists don't interact very much with their people around them, but their meaning takes place in the context of the progress of science over the centuries. So, but with regard to people, again, you've got to ask, how does a person evaluate their goals and their meaningfulness of their goals? And again, they're part of a community, so they see themselves in the eyes of the community standards, and that complicates it once again, I think.
Yeah, so one thing I want to say is, real quick, that one reason why people think that subjectivism is inadequate is that they think that people can be wrong about the meaningfulness of their lives, right? So let's say, for example, that I adopt a view where if I believe that my life is meaningful, my life is thereby meaningful. You couldn't be wrong. But we think, a lot of people think that you can be wrong about whether or not your life is meaningful, which means there has to be some other standard to evaluate lives. Maybe that's a community standard. There are philosophers who adopt an intersubjective view, right, where the community develops the standards by which we evaluate what is worthwhile. But a lot of these philosophers are assuming that there is objective value that's not culturally relative, that exists, you know, some things are just valuable and some things are not valuable. And I will say, I do find this, you know, if you end up reading like Susan Wolf, for example, who takes this approach, some people have argued that it's sort of an elitist account because she tells us what she thinks is objectively valuable, like apart from what people say. And of course, other people are like, no, I do think playing video games is objectively valuable. Right? I think there's a real worry that maybe there isn't this thing called objective value that's independent of cultural standards.
I mean, I think there is.
I think, so I'll be honest, I'm what you might be made clear from my meaninglessness account is I'm largely a subjectivist. Right? Ultimately, my account of meaninglessness is when people find their lives to be meaningless. Right? It's largely subjective because, quite frankly, I'll just say real quick, I feel compelled by the idea, or really, I find it convincing, the idea that people could lead morally atrocious lives, for example, yet still lead a meaningful life. Right? And maybe one of the bummers for why someone like Hitler, the bummers for Hitler, is that Hitler may have led a meaningful life, and we wish he didn't. Right? And we really wish he didn't. But of course, we have enough to evaluate him for morality. So I tend to be more of a subjectivist about this stuff.
So first let me say thank you for the presentation, for the provocative discussion. Because this is the philosopher's forum, and because we're talking about meaningfulness and meaninglessness, I'm wondering what is the meaningful, why is speaking about meaninglessness and meaninglessness and meaningfulness meaningful? Why is this a meaningful question? Why is it meaningful in general?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so that's a really good question. I think that, for one, we all do have an intuitive sense that there is something we're talking about when we talk about our lives being meaningful. We frequently make choices in our lives that seem to suggest that we have some idea of that. So, for example, there are people who quit their corporate jobs and go to work to spend more time at home with their family and to work on the farm. Right? People make drastic changes in their lives, and it doesn't seem to be motivated necessarily by considerations of pleasure. It seems to be motivated by considerations of what is worthwhile, what's significant. Right? If, when I get to my deathbed and I look back on my life, will I feel like I really lived a worthwhile life?
Why is this a philosophical question?
Why is it a philosophical? Ultimately, it's a value question. I mean, what philosophers are doing is trying to come up with standards to say, well, this is what you need in your life in order to lead a meaningful life. This is very related to the question of well-being and what a good life is for someone. And so, you know, this is sort of another way of evaluating human lives. This is a value question.
It looks like you're trying to discuss patterns that exist to see meaning in the pattern, and then the pattern of the meaning, and seeing if they can resonate with each other to come to an agreement about what constitutes a valid pattern that we can see, that then we can say, okay, that's an example of something that maybe creates self-actualization moments.
So it's like pattern, like looking for patterns in people's lives that seem to make them feel
in order to determine what. Richard M. Buck wrote a book, Cosmic Consciousness, and it, he went and looked at all these great minds that existed through analyzing their literature to see if they were experiencing the cosmic or self-actualization.
Yeah.
And that would be, I mean, Maslow talked about self-actualization as being one of the higher states of
you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering what you thought about how self-actualization gets into this.
I mean, I think that the notion of self-actualization is closely tied to meaningfulness. I think that that is one interpretation, really, what meaningfulness is all about. And some philosophers have argued something along those lines. I will say that with the pattern idea that you came up with, I think that's what a lot of philosophers are doing. So, for example, what some philosophers will do is they look at great literary achievements, artistic achievements, and moral achievements, and they say, what do these things all have in common? Right. Is there one feature that we can explain that explains why we think that these lives are awesome? And that seems to be the goal of a lot of philosophers, is starting with these examples of lives that seem intuitively really meaningful, and then trying to pull out what they have in common. So I think you're right about that.
I have some quick comment. I have my own kind of theory that people pick up a narrative structure just as we might pick up language, and that narrative structure says something to the effect of that.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I have this kind of theory in my own studies that people pick up a narrative structure much in the same way that they pick up language, meaning, you know, they pick up a why am I here, where if I jump from here, am I going, what am I doing? And that might be, you know, football is a metaphor for life, or, you know, cricket, or Allah, or whatever it is. Right. Anyhow, and I really enjoyed how you talked about the disconnect and how people might say, oh wait, hold on, I feel powerlessness because I'm connected or taken away from my future. So the meaningfulness, you know, might just be simply like an artifact of the environment. Like they grew up going, I'm going to detect meaning, and then I'm going to, like, you know, into this cognitive structure, and then if I get too far away from that, it's going to be meaninglessness.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, because in the draft of the paper that this is inspired by, I go into more detail, you know, this ability to project yourself into the future. I call it a meaning narrative.
Yes.
And so I say, we construct these narratives for the protagonists of the story, right? And we make sense of our lives by sort of imagining how we want to be, or how we feel like we ought to be, and then we examine our life in you know, in relation to this narrative. Right? To the extent that your actual life starts to go in a different direction than this idea of how you think your life should be, you start to feel... So I think, yeah, I completely agree with that. Yeah.
Is the subjective meaninglessness life more vulnerable to manipulation? For example, in coal mine in West Virginia, you know, a couple of decades ago, they had 800,000 people in coal mines. Now there's 80,000. The people living there, their towns are disintegrating. It's futile for them to think about the future because things are just continually getting worse. But then, today or yesterday, the EPA, Scott Pruitt, announced that the war on coal is dead. And now their life has meaning.
Yay.
Are you more vulnerable when you're subjectively in a meaninglessness locket?
Yeah.
Are you more vulnerable to manipulation?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I like the example itself because I think that this is exactly the sort of thing we should be looking at when it comes to people's lives losing meaning, in the sense of, you know, here's a case where you know, you take away people's important sources of meaning in their lives. It's not just that, like, oh, they need to find new meanings, right? It's more difficult. You can't just pick up and start over very easily. So I like that example. Are people more manipulatable, if that's a word? I don't know. I mean, the thing is, if you are actually in this sort of radical state of meaninglessness, you can't even imagine things worth doing that would be valuable. So I would think that actually you might be even less susceptible to manipulation because you're just going to be like, whatever. You know, like...
Scott Pruitt is using them, though.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. And those people who find their lives meaningless, can they be especially exploited? Right, that's a really interesting question. Yeah, I agree that's super interesting.
Yeah, I think one kind of thought about whether there is a continuum that where understanding of meaningfulness or meaninglessness slides based on trauma. For example, if there's a trauma and a person is disabled, is there a public perception, is there a societal perception that meaning changes and meaningfulness and meaninglessness changes? Has anyone thought about that?
I'm not sure. I mean, to be frank, when it comes to analytic philosophy and specifically the meaningfulness literature, very little has been written on meaning. Very little has been written on meaning in general, but meaninglessness, very little. Right? So there's not a lot. Now, granted, there are areas of feminist philosophy that deal with some of the disability studies issues and that sort of thing, but I'm not familiar with that. But I do think, that's an interesting question. When it comes to mind, since it's really subjective, what explains when people find their lives to be meaningless, I'm thinking about this from the first personal perspective and not so much the community perspective. But it does seem to me that the way in which community evaluates you or judges you, right, is your life meaningless now that you have this disability, could impact your own perception of yourself. That seems reasonable. Yeah.
So I just want to focus on your, I take it your key claim. So you have a model that is basically focusing on what I'll call agency disablement, right? Uh-huh. You want to find the key features of agency that are missing in certain forms of meaningless life. And I take it that the contrast case to that and the philosophers you looked at was your agency failure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you both share the intuition that agency is a necessary component of meaningfulness in life? And if so, or if not, are there any other features of the agency account in these other philosophers that you want to take the task?
So we do. We do share a commitment to the agency view, right? Because absolutely you're right. I think that one way of explaining what I'm doing here is talking about sort of like disabled agency or something like that. And that's absolutely what I'm doing. In this paper, 100%. I will say that I have been somewhat convinced that agency may not always be a requirement for meaningfulness. And one example, again, is Viktor Frankl. So Viktor Frankl states that, the attitude that you take towards your life and your death, these sorts of things can affect the meaningfulness of your life, right? Ultimately, you could find meaning in a concentration camp because people can't take away everything from you, right? The way in which you respond to the circumstances can add meaning to your life. I find that compelling. Now, some people are going to say that the way in which you respond to tragedy or circumstances is not action. It's response or something like that. I like the idea of that being potentially meaningful.
Just want to thank you for the talk. I really enjoyed it. Appreciated you bringing Viktor Frankl into the discussion. I've read a little bit of his work, and I found it just really inspiring and meaningful. Would you mind just touching on a couple of things that just in your own personal life brought you meaning?
Oh. That's interesting, huh? I have to say getting my PhD, yeah. defending my dissertation, I found writing a dissertation to be incredibly difficult, and making it through that was just a huge achievement for me. And so I found that to be very meaningful. It was just my 1-year wedding anniversary a couple days ago, and so I can't help but say, I think relationships are a really important source of meaning in people's lives. And I would say, having a steady partner in my life is really meaningful and important for me. One interesting question is whether or not we can talk about events being meaningful. And I like to think that we can. I think it's possible that some really negative events in our lives can be meaningful, which people aren't really working on that yet. But I think that there are profound moments like, the death of my neighbor and, loved ones and stuff like that that really stand out as really sort of life-altering moments that I would call meaningful too.
Can we condense this into one question?
What makes a life worth living?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think that there's actually a paper specifically on whether or not the question, is a life meaningful, the same as the question, whether or not a life is worth living? And I think those are distinct questions, actually. I think that, you know, here's an example. It could be that someone doesn't feel like they have a whole lot of goals left to accomplish. Maybe they're near the end of their lives, but they really take pleasure in viewing sunsets and eating fine meals. I think that life can be worth living, even if they don't feel like they have anything really important left to do, like in terms of accomplishing goals. And so I tend to think that there's more to life than just finding meaning in your life. Happiness is important, if maybe equally important. Pleasure is really important. All of these things, I think for many people, being a morally virtuous person is really important. And all of these things, I think, go into what makes a life a good life.
The question of value?
The question of value more generally, yeah. Yeah.
Hi. So I really enjoyed your talk. And I had a couple of thoughts and questions, but some people already touched on one of them, which was if there was any discussion around meaningful or meaninglessness being a proportional function of agency. So I think some people back there already touched on that. So I will ask, so you mentioned trauma or any sort of incident that robs you of the view that the world is a positive place where good things happen to good people.
Yeah.
So when I heard that, I thought that more so robs you of your hope than your agency.
Yeah.
So how does that affect the ability for one to find meaning in their lives? So just because the world is a dirtier, grimier place than you might once imagine, your ability to affect change in it is the same. So is your ability to find meaning in life any different than it was before?
Yeah, really good question. So one thing I want to say is, in my dissertation, I actually refer to meaninglessness as a type of agental hopelessness. I think they're very similar, right? I think ultimately they come down to maybe one type of hopelessness. But two, I think, so I mentioned here that, you know, trauma, for example, can impair your ability to project yourself into the future. Right? If you feel as though your future is going to be horrible, right, that it's going to be full of failure or trauma or just awful, it's going to be hard for you to find meaning in the present, right? Because you have to be able to project yourself into the future to form goals and ends and in order to get meaning now. So yeah, if you think that the rest of your life is just going to be awful, it is going to be hard to sort of find meaning now. And so I think this comes into play, yeah. If you feel as though either you're a horrible person that's not deserving of good things, or you think you live in a horrible world, or bad things can happen to you at any second, I think it's going to be difficult to really find meaning in those circumstances.
Yep. Sometimes people throughout history have done things that seem to be insignificant in their lives or
yeah.
their lifetime, but then 100 years or 200 years later, all of a sudden, they get discovered or whatever, and they find out that, you know, it changes like all of science or history or something like that.
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so actually one way in which people sometimes distinguish between, say, meaningfulness and happiness, that happiness has to occur during your life,
mm-hmm.
whereas you can add meaning to your life with things that happen after your life. That seems to be one unique thing about this value of a life. I'm totally on board with the idea that things that happen after your death can impact the meaningfulness of your life. Certainly, you know, I'm not huge on success, right? But if you think that success in your projects adds to the meaningfulness of your life, even a little bit, well, of course, some of these projects won't be, you know, completed until after your death. In which case, things that after you die can affect it.
But you don't benefit from it.
You don't know, right? But this would be, so this is a good question, because this is where the objective component comes into play. Right? You'll never know that you will necessarily, you know, accomplish those goals. But there is an objective fact of the matter, right, that you achieve those goals, whether or not you're aware of it. And so you might say that adds meaning to your life anyway.
Yeah.
They want us out of here by 9 o'clock so y'all can, you know, talk to Dr. Eggerstrom later afterwards. So one more question. I saw you first.
thank you. I'm just curious, have you
explore the possibilities of absolute and eternal meaninglessness, or absolute and eternal meaningfulness, perhaps based on the concept of absolute truth emanating from an infinite creator being who does pass judgment on what is meaningful and what is meaningless, both now and forever.
So I have dealt with this, the topic of meaningfulness, from purely a naturalist sort of secular perspective. I have not gotten into the religious questions, other than the fact that I think that loss of faith is one of those sort of radical experiences that can cause one to enter a meaningless period in their lives, right? So I've looked at it from that perspective, but I've not actually done very much on the bigger question of whether or not life in general is meaningful, right? Whether or not there's some meaning to the universe or some purpose in our existing. I don't have answers to those questions, right?
Thank you. As you can see, probably some of my questions,
I would love that.
That seems to me, of this vulnerability that they're talking about, is the phenomenon of recruitment to terrorism that's going on.
Yeah.
They seem to
find
that these recruits are in isolated and not much hope, you know, certainly no vision of the future.
Yeah.
Of a positive way. Seem like that's,
no, that's a really good point.
I like his example also.
That's really good.
I think also you see it in the
I think you're absolutely right. The search for meaning is so
good. It's not exclusive. You know, some of the people they recruit are more vulnerable.
Oh, right. I mean, I thought about this a lot from the perspective of prejudice and prejudice. Well, part of it is that, the meaning of your life is tied to religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And other people who are different seem to be well, then you want to attack those, and attacking the meaning of your life by simply existing. So I think that absolutely is a good point.
Very good. Thank you
so much. It was nice meeting you and chatting with you.
I'm looking for your question, guys. Yeah, absolutely. It's got to be. This book identifies
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I have an audible. That's
basically like two cubic quarters or the two cycle. One of the 10 guys that used to be in the entire was